Session number 216 58 will one.
Tony Colgan, Reel One, where were you born, please?
I was born in London, 19th of October, 1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in London? Your schooling in London?
Yes, I went to the Oratory. The Oratory just off Fulham Road. It belongs to the Brompton Oratory Church.
Did you live in Fulham?
No, I lived in Herne Hill, some distance away, yeah.
And how old were you when you left school?
Didn't leave school until until I was 17, and that was August Bank Holiday Monday, 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
No, I was riding a bike in Melbourne in Cambridgeshire when he declared war. Yes, but I've heard it many times since, of course. Yeah.
How did you come to be in Cambridgeshire?
Just before the war, a matter of days before the war started, the school packed up and we were all evacuated to Cambridgeshire as a school. Very happy situation it was too, with very pleasant people in there. And from that day onwards, I said, I want to live in a village. And eventually I left London many years after the war, came down to live in this.
So you were evacuated to Melbourne?
Melbourne, yeah.
Can you describe the evacuation, how it went?
Oh, yes. It went very well, actually. We mustered on to, walked up to South Kensington Station, where we got on a train that took us to probably to King's Cross, I would think, where we went on the train and got off at Hitchin, where buses were laid on to take us to Melbourne. We all assembled in the school then, and you were gradually allocated certain houses, or people were allocated certain boys and girls, incidentally. But I was very lucky in that we were very lucky in that we were allocated a room, room with a Mrs. Thurley, Mr. and Mrs. Thurley, who treated us very well. And they were real country people, talked like country Cambridge people did, and they were kindness itself. I was most sorry when we left there to go up to Clacton. For some reason or another, they were moving us away from Cambridgeshire, which I have no idea what the reason was. And from Clacton, we then moved right across to South Wales to the Rhondda Valley. And we all stayed in a place called Tonopandy, from which I left school from then about the July, end of July 1940, and joined the General Electric Company.
Was there any bad side to the evacuation in any of those three places?
We were always very well treated, and we were all quite happy. You know, there was never a problem that I ever came across. All the boys and girls seemed to integrate quite well, and there would never seem to be a problem with them. It was quite a happy situation, really.
Any homesickness?
Oh, I expect there was, but we used to go home occasionally. We'd get a bus home, or from from Wales, of course, we would get the train home. But it was only once, I think, or once or perhaps twice. That's all I ever went home for. There was nothing happening in London at the moment, and it didn't really start to happen until after I got home, and that was sometime in August. And then one day the air raid siren went, and that was the beginning of the air raids on London, which were pretty horrific at the time.
What was your address during the Blitz?
I lived in Tulse Hill, T-U-L-S-E, Tulse Hill.
Can you give details of what you experienced in the Tulse Hill Blitz, please?
Yes, there was a railway not all that far from the house, and we assumed that that's what they were going for. There was no other manufacturing or or factories of any kind near at hand. But nevertheless, bombing went on a more or less indiscriminate way, and houses in the road were bombed, and people we knew were killed, and there was also high explosive bombs were used, incendiary bombs. Then they started the ARP, RA precautions, which was most people joined it, and you were taught how to deal with incendiaries and general things that might occur during the bombing.
What instructions were you given for dealing with an incendiary?
Not to cover them in water, use sand to put them out, and not to, on any occasion, on any account, touch them, because there were things like butterfly bombs, which in fact would explode if you kick them there.
Did you ever come across a butterfly bomb?
No, but many incendiary bombs fell around the along the road and in the back garden and things like that.
Were you ever burnt or harmed?
No.
Do you remember any specific roads or buildings that were hit in your area?
Yeah, I can remember there was a house 50 yards away that was just taken out, you know, literally bombed. And I think there were about 3 or 4 people killed in that one house. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I think it was.
Mm. What was your actual address?
118 Christchurch Road, yeah.
Did you ever use shelters?
We did have one in the back garden, but after a while, I think people got accustomed to the bombing and they just slept in their own bed. It wasn't very comfortable in the shelter. You'd get probably about 10 people in there, and there was only room to sit down. You certainly couldn't stretch out and go to sleep. So eventually people went back to their own houses and only used it if they were really worried. But they used to, eventually these air raid shelters filled up with water anyway because there was no drainage or things like that. So that was another good reason for not using them. They're always damp even at on the best occasion. But yeah, people got accustomed to the bombing after a time.
Did you think at this stage the Germans would win the war?
No, we never ever thought that. I can't ever remember somebody saying that they thought we might lose, yeah. Not on any occasion, yeah.
Did you listen to wireless at that time?
Oh, yes. That was the only form of entertainment, the radio, and or wireless. And, yes, we used to hear all, even listen to what they used to call him, Lord Haw-Haw, didn't they? I can't remember his other name now.
William Joyce.
William Joyce, that's right, yes. He had a sort of very nasally kind of voice. But I think it was done more for amusement because we enjoyed Tommy Handy and Itmar at the same time. So it was just another entertaining programme, really, I suppose. Nobody ever believed what he said.
Any other experiences from this period?
It was a question of get home, prepare for the nightly raid. Yes, there was. I worked for the General Electric Company for a while in Kingsway. And, of course, I was only a young 17-year-old boy, and I used to suffer with nosebleeds a lot. And one day I had a nosebleed at the while I was at work, and I went up to the nurse in the first aid centre, and she said, lie down on that couch. And she said, how much sleep did you have last night? So I said, about 2 hours, I suppose, same as everybody else. So she said, well, just lie down then. Of course, I dozed off. And I went to sleep for the whole afternoon and got back to the office just as about they were all about to go home. So you could, odd little bits of kindness like that you'd come across, yeah.
Did you suffer very much from lack of sleep?
Oh, yes. While the bombing was going on, it did go on for quite some time. you couldn't sleep because the noise was so great. There was anti-aircraft guns going off. There were aeroplanes screaming overhead. There were bombs whistling down. Occasional aircraft get hit and make a hell of a bang or noise as it was going down. It was a generally unpleasant time, and then, of course, there was food rationing as well. That was another thing you had to contend with. So it was a question of cooking as and when you could, rather than as and when you wanted to. Because raids started, especially during the winter, raids started almost as soon as you got home. Went on for quite some time.
Mm. Were you living by yourself or at home?
No, with the family. My mother, of course, my mother was widowed before the war, and I had my eldest brother was in the army, and my two sisters and other brother were at home. Yeah. Oh, my youngest sister was evacuated as well. Mm.
Was your mother a Londoner?
No, she was Welsh, actually. She was born in the Valleys.
So did this lack of sleep take it out of you?
Oh, yes, yes. It was something you really sort of took every opportunity to have 40 winks, yeah.
What happened to you next?
Then it was call-up time. And I, on the 16th of July 1942, I joined the Buffs at Canterbury for 12 weeks initial training.
What was the training like?
Pretty tough, but interesting as well. I don't think I've ever been so fit in my life, because you were... as soon as you got up, you were doubling away, running somewhere or the other. And the training was intensive. It wasn't just running. It was also teaching rifles, machine guns, how they worked, and so on. All the general infantry training that you would expect. Cross-country running. And after 12 weeks, we were given a week's leave, and then posted to another the same regiment, but in another section where we were divided into whether we would be signalers or drivers or just ordinary infantrymen. And I plumped for driving brain gun carriers. There's one there. I drove one for the rest of the war. Yes. There's a place called the Old Park at Canterbury, and that's where we learned our driving, and I'd never been behind the wheel of anything, nothing at all. And all of a sudden this Lance Corporal said to me, well, go on then, get in. Well, go on. And I just pressed everything, and it seemed to go, it'd be the right order, and off we went. And so I carried on driving from then on, and I ended up in... I drove up to, eventually up to Berlin. Yeah.
Was it easy to drive?
No, it was a crash gearbox, and it worked on the principle of braking one track to steer. So it was different to driving in another car, an ordinary car. And instead of when you come to a turning, you drop your revs in a car to turn with a brain gun carrier, you drop your gears, but you increase your revs to give you enough power to turn the tracks, because you've got about, I can't remember how heavy it was, about 4 or 5 tons, I suppose, because it's all armour. It was an interesting thing to drive. You had no windscreen, of course, and if you were going any speed, and they... 25 miles an hour was considered you were really pushing your luck, because they would slide very easily on things like cobble. If a track got broken at that kind of speed, you just couldn't brake, because there was nothing to brake on. If your track broken, you shed your track, you only braked on the other side then, and of course it would just swirl and turn over, swirl round and turn over. It was quite an interesting thing to drive, but If you ever got up to 30 miles an hour, very few people did. Yes. It was about 90 horsepower, I think, our current rating. Yeah.
What's a crash gearbox?
Oh, there's no synchromesh gears, so you've got to be pretty exact when you rev to change down, because otherwise you start you can hear your gears grating. Mm.
Did you enjoy driving them?
Oh yeah, it was quite a pleasure. Yeah, bit of fun. I wouldn't mind driving one now, actually. Mm.
What happened to you next?
After training, we went down to Devon for subsequent training as an infantry unit, as a battalion. That was the 10th Battalion, the Buffs, Newton Abbott, I think we were. And then we went up to Shildon in County Durham, eventually, where we got prepared to go overseas.
What was it like in County Durham?
It was pretty grim. We were in a hall of some kind. We weren't there for very long, but the surroundings were terraced houses, rather miserable grey kind of bricks. It wasn't a very attractive place to live around. Although the people were always very nice and helpful. We weren't there for long, though.
And then?
Off we went to Liverpool to catch the Britannic, I think my ship was. It was about 28,000 tonnes, and took us to North Africa.
What was the voyage like in that?
It wasn't bad, actually, because we were in hammocks, so that wasn't very pleasant. But then, of course, young men, you can adapt to anything of that kind. The sea was not bad. Some were seasick, but then some would be seasick anyway. But we went in convoy, so it was a fairly fast convoy, and you could see on the horizon cruisers and destroyers and so on appear from time to time, and then you get the occasional naval craft would come steaming through the convoy, and they would be dropping depth charges, and I don't know whether they ever got a submarine, but they were certainly keen on having a go at them. And then occasionally they would fire off. They had probably a 4.5 gun on the back end, and they would fire that off. But I think they did that more for practice than anything else. But it certainly brought everybody to attention, you know, sort of, and charging up on deck, see what was going on, because they thought perhaps they'd run into a German warship. Yeah. But they hadn't. So it was, other than the depth charging, it was a pretty uneventful crossing. But it took a long time, took about a month to get from Liverpool to Algiers. They steamed out as far as the east coast of America and then back again to avoid submarines. But no ship in our convoy was touched, so they were quite a successful convoy. And then we went on from there. We caught another ship called the Santa Rosa, which was a Liberty ship. And it was probably the most uncomfortable ship you've ever been on. There was nowhere to sleep. You just had to curl up where you could, on deck or down in the hold or something like that. And the most remarkable thing about it was the food, because we hadn't had white bread since the beginning of the war. And you had to queue up for your meals, and it took about 4 hours to get to the top end of the queue. And the food was absolutely delicious. It was things we hadn't had for a long time in England. As I say, white bread and things like that. It was really nice. The only trouble is, as soon as you finish one meal, you had to start queuing for your next one, because it took another 4 hours to get. So I only got, I think, about two or three meals on the whole voyage, which took us into Philippeville.
Was this an American crew?
Yes, it was an American crew, yes, yeah.
What happened at Philippeville?
There we were marched up to a transit camp where we were all assembled, and we assumed that we were going to the bus. And my brother, Meredith's brother, was in the bus, and he was expecting me because I told him we were on our way out in a letter to him. And before he had a chance to sort of say, come along and see me or something, we'd gone on across to Sicily. But he actually applied for me to join him, but it was too late to do anything then. Just as well I didn't, because most of the crowd that did go with them went on to Italy and were killed. Yeah, so it was a bit of luck. We went by train from Philippeville to Sousse, and we stayed there for a few days and then went on by landing craft, was the small landing craft with a gangway down either side of the bows. I don't know whether you've ever seen them. I think it was called an LCA landing craft assault. I'm not quite sure, but we spent 2 days on that, steaming across to Sicily, where we landed at a place called Avola, A-V-O-L-A, and of course, inevitably, to a German air raid.
Was it an opposed landing?
No, it was. There was nothing there. They'd already gone on. The invasion of Sicily had actually happened about a few days to a week beforehand. So the actual frontline troops were some distance on. They were up towards a place called Primosoli Bridge. We're in camp, therefore, only about a mile from where we landed, and we camped there for a matter of a few days. And then we got orders to march up towards the front line because there was no transport available to take us, so it was a question of marching. We spent 3 days marching up to the assembly point where we were going to be allocated battalions and companies and so on. And eventually we arrived at the battalion, and I was allocated to the 3-inch mortars.
Which battalion was that?
9th Battalion of Zanlite Infantry. So it was completely different end of the country from the battalion I anticipated joining, you know, which was the Buffs. And I stayed in the Durham Light Infantry for the rest of the war.
How did this battalion differ from the one you'd been in England?
It was an active service battalion, of course. Discipline, when you were talking about fighting the war, was absolutely spot on, intense. But comradeship and friendliness and helpfulness of everybody was an entirely different thing. It was a comradeship as you hear about. Everybody had to muck in and do the job together. So you never got anybody grumbling about or what they had to do when it came to, say, firing a mortar or driving the carrier or whatever they had to do. They never grumbled about their particular job. Yeah, it was an intensely friendly attitude to from everybody, I think, really. And we joined the battalion at a place called Primosoli Bridge. It's quite famous in the Durhams, as it was an intensive action that had actually occurred a few days before I joined them. Gliders had come in from North Africa and landed there, so they had quite a fight there to gain the bridge. And a lot of the gliders had been released over the sea, and it was a bone of contention with the paratroopers afterwards And there's quite a story about it. It's still talked about even now. And I've never really come across a really valid excuse why they released the gliders early. When paratroops are not in the action for longer than the actual battle they are assigned to, they're withdrawn then and ordinary infantry take over, because they might well be used for something else, some other airborne operation.
Which company and platoon were you allocated to in the battalion?
Yeah, 3-inch mortar in support company, yeah.
Had you had experience on 3-inch mortars before?
No, but I was taken on as a driver, a carrier driver. But I soon learned how to fire one. Because if there was a lot of firing to do, we'd swap over roles. But the role of a driver was to supply ammunition. So you would, once you got to your firing position, you would dismount the mortar, dig the mortar in. Then the driver's job was to put the ammunition ready for firing. And then occasionally we would just swap roles, and I would fire the mortar, and there were three gun numbers, and I would take over one of the gun numbers. On a later occasion, but just before the end of the war, this is quite a story, I suppose. We were waiting for the surrender to be negotiated through our lines up near Hamburg, and two mortars were allocated to go forward of the forward infantry to do a shoot. And it was, the Germans didn't want to rock the boat too much, so there was not much, no problems from them, and we used to spend the day out there and fire as and when we required. And then all the chaps seemed to, there was a quiet period, and they seemed to wander off, and I got left on my own, and suddenly the orders came to fire. There was only me to fire, two guns. What the hell do I do? I said to the corporal in charge. He said, just bloody well get on with it. And so I got into one pit, fired, laid on, got jumped out of that one, fired, laid on again. And then as the order came, so I was jumping from one gun to the other. I got about four or five rounds off before they all heard the mortar going and they came charging back. So I was quite pleased to see them, actually. But it was quite an intensive, say, 5 or 10 minutes. I certainly can't tell you how long it was. I was so concentrated on what I was doing. And it needs two people to lay the mortar on, one to get the elevation and one to get the direction. Of course, every shot you fire, it goes off because the base plate of the mortar goes down into the ground and gives you, alters the trajectory of the mortar. Mm. So it meant you had to wind those down, you know, but otherwise your mortar would be firing all over the place. But that was, that's going on a bit, yeah.
So that was just before VE Day?
Yes, yeah, yeah. But that's hopping over a year ahead, yes.
Let's go back to Primicelli Bridge.
Primicelli Bridge. You know all about Primicelli Bridge, really, do you?
Well, I've heard some of the airborne who've talked about it, yeah. But can you tell me your personal story, yeah. Please?
No, I that's all I know about it. I arrived there with the gliders on the ground, and I had a look round them, of course, and there were some of the fronts open that had jeeps in, and there was machine gun cartridge cases all over the place. So it must have been some kind of firefight. I was asked to write a book on my first, an article on my first day in action, and I did actually that. And I'll let you have a copy of it in a minute. But we joined the regiment, and they were actually in reserve. And there's hills up behind on our side of the river for where Primicelli Bridge crossed, and we were in a cave at the top of the hill. And occasionally Jay would fire a shot or two. They're never very close to us. just to let him know he knew we were there. And then we went from reserve to take our four positions, and our colonel and second in command went out to reconnoitre these positions, and they were spotted by the enemy and they were fired on and they were both killed. So I arrived at the regiment when at a time when two of the most senior officers just were no more. There was a lot of people were very sad because they're quite popular officers. One was Colonel Percy, and the other I think was Major Campbell. Big Billy was known as. I never met either of them.